Hello. In recent audio snippets, we have been talking about Black America, and we've been going back in time, trying to get a sense of how slavery developed, you could say, or how the issue of slavery remaining as part of American society, how that kind of became a bigger and bigger problem until we got to the point where slavery was something that we couldn't get away from. And to get away from it, eventually we had to go through a civil war that killed over half a million Americans. And so we've been talking about the acts in the last snippet, the acts that began to get enacted both in America and even in the UK, that began to work to limit and eventually end slavery, at least in the UK. So we know that by the 19th century, as the century went from 18th to 19th, the awareness that there was something very wrong with the whole system of slavery, that awareness was there. It's not as if everybody thought everything was okay and they just went on with their lives. Everybody knew something was wrong. It's just that the people who needed to take that last step to complete the end of slavery in America, just those people never took that final step and refused to do so. And today we're going to briefly talk about a few people at the beginning of the 19th century in America that you could say might have had a relevant role in turning the tide of the in terms of the slavery issue, but were unwilling or in some cases unable to. And the first person we're going to talk about is James Monroe. He was the fifth president of the United States right after James Madison. James Madison was in the White House, if I'm not mistaken, for a period of 8 years. And then came James Monroe, and Madison was the one, the main writer of the U.S. Constitution. So we had like as I've shared before, the person I really consider like the father of the country, more so than George Washington. James Madison, the one who basically wrote the schematics of how this country was legally built, you could say. George Washington was a general and an important figure in many respects, but in terms of his effect on the legal system and the things we had to live through from then on, you could say that James Madison had a much greater influence. Basically, the greatest legacy from the legal standpoint of Washington, George Washington, was to solidify the position of the executive branch as an executive branch that did not degrade into a royalty type position. By him refusing to continue as president after two terms, he was kind of saying, I am not a king. And he allowed for the transition of power to a new person, who in his case was John Adams, who became the second president. So that was his legacy from the legal standpoint. But James Madison had a much more profound imprint on the legal system, the legal structures of America. And as we've discussed in throughout these audio snippets, a lot of that influence is very negative. But the blame does not go exclusively to Madison. It goes to everyone who went along with the system and who goes along with the system even to this day, i.e. the conservatives who worship everything that was left behind by the founding fathers. So we have this father of the country, James Madison in power for 8 years. The issue of slavery is basically still there. Nothing is changing. And then comes James Monroe. He was president from 1817 through 1825. And he was born into a slave-owning family in Virginia. And he himself owned dozens of slaves. And in fact, when he became president and went to Washington, he took some of his own personal slaves with him to serve him in the White House. And that was not an uncommon thing for slave-owning presidents to do, because at that time there was no, if I'm not, from what I understand, no congressional allotment for the White House to have a hire a staff of its own. So the president kind of had to come up with his own people separately, and that's why they always brought slaves, if they owned them, to the White House. So Monroe did just that. And, but what we're trying to emphasize is that he was not just a person who owned a couple of slaves. He was a prolific slave owner, if we can say it that way. But the odd thing is, we always have this dichotomy with a lot of these people as we went through them, as we've been discussing. When he left the, when he left the White House and went back to Virginia, there was in 1829, so 4 or 5 years after he had left the White House, there was a constitutional convention that was held in Virginia that was convoked to deal with some issues that the people of Virginia had with their constitution, the state constitution, if I'm not mistaken. And there was this Constitutional Convention of Virginia in 1829, and James Monroe was elected as president of that convention, Constitutional Convention. And as president of the Constitutional Convention, he reiterated to the people there that his belief that slavery was a blight, which even as a British colony, Virginia had attempted to eradicate. So he tried to portray it as something that was shameful to Virginia, but it was but Virginia wanted, was stuck with it, because when it tried to eradicate it, the British didn't let them. And you can see the kind of ironic shame and hypocrisy in his statement, because it's so ironic that 4 years after he said that, the British passed the act that we talked about before, the Slavery Abolition Act of 1833, that basically ended slavery throughout the British Empire. It was a gradual end, and by 1838, 9 years after this, after Monroe said these things, that's when officially slavery was completely over. It was a gradual process, because it had to have a certain gradual nature to it. There was justification for it to be gradual, but not too gradual in the sense of taking forever. In the case of the British, it took 5 years, and then it was done. And so the very British, the very people that Monroe was blaming slavery on in Virginia were ending slavery throughout the whole British Empire. But he was at least recognizing that there was something wrong with it. He was just too proud to admit that Virginia had anything to do with this evil. And ironically, he was saying it after having been the fifth American president, meaning that there had already been five presidents of an independent American nation that was no longer bound to the British crown. and could do whatever they wanted. And but even so, as a free American, having been the fifth American president in the American nation history, he was still blaming the British for slavery in Virginia. So what did the British have to do in 1829 with slavery in Virginia? But that's how his mind operated. And that's how the minds of a lot of people in America operated. This kind of dichotomy, this schizophrenia of, on the one hand, recognizing the evil of slavery, and then on the other hand, doing nothing about it and just creating a whole bunch of excuses for it to continue. The other interesting thing is that he was a member of what we can call what was called the American Colonization Society, a hideous society that was made up of Quakers and slave owners. And this society's intent was to basically, how I would phrase it, is to basically deport as many black people as possible back to Africa or to some other country, some other place, to go live their lives there. So it was kind of an effort to end slavery, but through deportation. And the society was made up of Quakers and slave owners. And you would say, why would a slave owner want to do this? What happened is that... you can understand why Quakers want to do it. They wanted to end slavery. They saw it as evil, and in their silly little heads, they thought the way to end slavery was by getting rid of black people, or sending them back to Africa or some other place. But slave owners also joined in this society because they wanted to get rid, maybe not of all slaves, but just the free ones, the freed black people in America. Because if you could deport them, send them back to Africa, just have black slaves here and no black free person, then that would end or diminish the likelihood of slave insurrections. So they were kind of thinking like that. That's why they were joining in the society. So you can see that if you have slave owners joining a society that's opposed to end slavery, you have to kind of imagine there is some sort of double intent there. There's something not right with the society that wants to end slavery and has as its members a lot of slave owners. One of the people who helped to found this society was Henry Clay. He helped to found it in 1816. And Henry Clay is one of the most important figures in early American history. He had a lot of influence on a lot of things that happened during the first few decades of this nation's legislative activity, and so we have James Monroe, who recognizes slavery's evil. He joins this American Colonization Society, thinking, okay, there's a solution. The solution is to deport slaves, and this society helped actually to send several thousand freed slaves to the new colony of Liberia in Africa from 1820 to 1840. And as some of you may know, the capital of Liberia in Africa is called Monrovia. And Monrovia is actually named in honor, if you can say it like that, quote, in honor of James Monroe. So that tells you how influential Monroe was within the American Colonization Society, that the slaves who arrived in Liberia, thinking, oh, well, you know, we are free, honored Monroe by naming that city Monrovia. And the thing is that, as we said, this society included a lot of slave owners who were concerned about how the number of free black people and how dangerous they could be in terms of organizing or stirring up some sort of slave revolt, kind of like what happened in Haiti, that turned very bloody in Haiti, by the way, and a lot of white people got massacred in that revolt. So they were fearing some sort of revolt like that. And it was because the number of free blacks in America in 1790, for example, was 60,000. And by 1830, it had grown to 300,000. So the number of free blacks was growing and growing. And the society said, oh, let's send them all, as many as we can, back to Africa. Since the 1840s, Lincoln, Abraham Lincoln, who was an admirer of this Henry Clay we just mentioned, had been an advocate of this American Colonization Society and of the deporting of blacks to Liberia. And even during the Civil War, Lincoln was actively pursuing the deportation option, and he actually thought of Haiti as a way, as a place that we could send black people to. And there was a man named Mitchell, in fact, during the Civil War, who was appointed by Lincoln in 1862 to oversee the government's deportation plan. So they wanted to, like, because, you know, the Civil War was raging in America. Lincoln didn't know what to do, and he appointed this man to say, okay, let's work on this massive plan of sending black people maybe to Haiti to get rid of them and then end the Civil War. So that's how Lincoln was thinking. And all of those those Americans who stupidly admire Lincoln, and I was one of them as a child, because we all grew up, you know, kind of being taught to admire this man. And I admired him for a long time, and I actually thought of him as the greatest president in American history. But the more I began to look into him, I realized, oh my goodness, this guy was an idiot, a stupid idiot. He had the opportunity. Maybe he wasn't as evil as other people, but what was wrong with him is that he was put in a position in history to do something. He had every opportunity to do all these things, and he didn't do them. He refused to do them. He was put in a moment in history, a very transcendental moment, and given an opportunity that no one else had been given in American history to do certain things, and he did not do them. He refused to do them. And we have suffered as a result. So people who worship Lincoln don't understand where he was. You think of him as a great emancipator, a great liberator of black people, but he wasn't that at all. And we'll talk about that a little bit later, just to give you a greater sense of how off this man was. I know that people have flaws and everything, but this is more than just a quote little flaw. It was a fundamental flaw, problem in him, and that's why he is, to me, one of the worst presidents we've ever had. Because he didn't do what had to be done. I mean, what he did, any person with some decency and character, the good things he did, would have done. There's nothing to praise about him, you know, fighting to keep the Union together. Anyone would have done that. But he did it the wrong way. But we'll talk about that later. The thing is that he was very supportive of this society. James Monroe was one of, I guess, founding members of. I don't know if he was a founding member, but he was a very influential member of it at the beginning when it started. And this American Colonization Society deported it had so much influence. It didn't get to deport as many slaves as it wanted, thankfully. But it kept going and going even after the Civil War, and it deported its last blacks to Liberia in 1904. Imagine that, we're into the 20th century. Now we have another bad president, Teddy Roosevelt, in the White House in 1904, and they're still deporting black people to Liberia. And that is sad because all these people who were sent back to Liberia, their children were born in Africa and they grew up there, and all those kids should have been born here and grown up here and had the opportunity to live out the American dream. They would be here today, their descendants. And they're not there because these stupid idiots sent them to Liberia. And the black people who went there, well, I don't blame them for, you know, agreeing to be taken back. They were fooled. But nonetheless, you know, they were, their lives were altered. Their future generations did not get to receive the benefits of their own sacrifice, of what they had suffered through in America. So they suffered it for naught. And then the future generations who could reap the benefits of having, of being American after having gone through all that heartache, didn't get to receive those benefits. So this society was still doing its thing, a society supported by Lincoln. One of the other things that's worth mentioning is that a lot of the people who were sent back to Africa died very young or on the way back. So there was a lot of mortality going on during that deportation process. And people who arrived in Liberia, they were Americans. The black Americans who arrived in Liberia didn't fit in. They it's not like, oh, we're home, and they enjoyed life. They went back and they felt like foreigners because they were Americans. And they brought in a different thinking. They brought in a lot of constitutional thinking, ironically. You know, a lot of Republican, and I don't mean the party. I mean the concept of Republican, of a republic. A lot of Republican thinking, constitutional thinking, was taken to Liberia with them. So because they were Americans, they had an American mindset that differed from the mindset of the people living in that part of Africa at the time. So it was a very sad thing to have them leave and go there because they didn't belong there. They belonged here in America. So they suffered, you know, the transition of going there. A lot of them physically died because they couldn't adapt to the environment, to the climate, and to the diseases and things like that there. And there were other similar colonies besides Liberia that were established. There was one called Mississippi in Africa, kind of a creepy name. There was another colony around that same part of West Africa called Kentucky in Africa. And there was one called the Republic of Maryland, you know, just like the state of Maryland here in the U.S., where I grew up. There was a Republic of Maryland in Africa. So there were these similar colonies. And so that's what the society did. This is what James Monroe belonged to, and Henry Clay also belonged to it. And Henry Clay, I call him kind of the king of kind of do, kind of don't. That's how I consider him. He had a lot of noble qualities, but at the end of the day, he was always kind of on the fence when it came to the issue of slavery. And even though he was a very influential man, he never really did anything to really end slavery. Henry Clay actually inherited slaves as a young child, and he owned slaves throughout his life. In the 1790s, he began to adopt anti-slavery views. And he was not like a person who believed in the equality of black people and white people. He saw slavery, he began to see slavery as wrong, even as he owned slaves. And he also believed in treating free blacks with respect and everything. But he never really believed in just abolishing slavery outright. Actually, early in his career, political career, he did favor a process of gradual emancipation in Kentucky and Missouri. Kentucky, because if I'm not mistaken, that's where he was from. He was born in Hanover County, Virginia, but he began his legal career in Lexington, Kentucky. And he was elected to the Kentucky state legislature, and then he became a congressman, a member of the House of Representatives for the state of Kentucky. So he was basically a Kentuckian, even though he was originally born in Virginia. The thing is that he early on in his career, he did advocate for a gradual emancipation process in the state of Kentucky, his home state, and his birth state of Virginia. But he basically was unsuccessful. He didn't convince people, and then he after that, he advocated for that in Kentucky and Missouri, but each state rejected the plans that he was proposing, and he continued to support this concept of gradual emancipation. He always said that he would be in support of it if it included a plan for colonizing free blacks somewhere else. It was, yes, let's set them free, when we set them free, let's ship them out of here. That's kind of what he was like. And the sad thing is, this man was very, very influential in Congress. Apparently, he had some sort of charisma or some sort of intelligence that exuded from him, something about him. And he could have used that to galvanize Congress to get them to really end slavery, because he did recognized that slavery had to end, and he was talking about an emancipation. So he was kind of in the ballpark. That's why I call him the kind of do, kind of don't king, because he wanted to go there, but he just never really took the step to go there. And had he committed to a very clear plan, we have to do this, this, and this, and then also laid out the moral justifications, saying, well, this is what we're supposed to do, because if we don't, we are going to reap the consequences in the long term, and bring destruction to the South and to this country. If he had been able to formulate it, I'm pretty sure he would have affected Congress enough to do something, and we might not have had a civil war. Who knows? But we will never know, because he never tried. Going back to James Monroe was willing to have the federal government provide financial assistance in emancipating and deporting slaves back to Africa. So, in other words, he wanted this deportation thing done, and he believed that the federal government was supposed to provide financial assistance. This kind of went against the trends of state rights as a Southerner, because Southerners were always about state rights, you know, no federal government, we don't want those evil feds. It's all about the states and state governments and state rights. And he kind of went against that Southern trend by saying the federal government should play an important role in this freeing of the slaves by kicking them out of their own country. And the same with Clay. Clay also believed in an activist government, federal government, when it came to the issue of slavery. So it's interesting that these men were anti-federalists, anti-federalism when it came to the issue of slavery, because at the end of the day, slavery could not, you could not have slavery and state rights at the same time. Federalism was the foundation of slavery. That's what kept it going. And these men kind of subconsciously knew that you could not end the slavery problem without kind of temporarily doing away with federalism in some way. It had to be imposed in a centralized way from the federal government on down. There was no other way to do it. And as we've said, to me, the whole discussion of whether it's the federal government or the state government, that is such an artificial separation. You know, the government at whatever level is supposed to enforce or protect the rights of the individual, no matter what level it is, city, state, or federal. So there should be no worrying about the layer that the protection is coming from. If you're in the state legislature, you're supposed to protect the rights of the individual. If you're at the federal level, you're supposed to protect the rights of the individual. It should not matter. But these artificial layers that federalism creates, conceptual layers, is what creates and preserves artificial problems and keeps them going. So just as a side note, at the time of this recording, the Supreme Court has made a decision to end or to overturn Roe v. Wade, the federal case that legalized abortion in the United States. And conservatives are all happy. I'm happy that that has happened, but the happiness that conservatives have about that is so sad. And I'm partially happy, but I'm still sad, because now abortion, the issue of abortion, will be decided at the state level. And I was reading a headline in a conservative website that's about, it was some conservative idiot wrote something like, we finally have the right solution. We have what should have been there from the beginning, divorce American style. And what he meant by that was that now we're going to have, one state supporting abortion and the other state abolishing abortion, and we're going to have this divorce in this country, and that's the way it's supposed to be. And I go, my goodness, what the hell's going on in these people's brains? That's exactly how slavery happened, where America just began to grow and grow apart because of that dichotomy that the federalist system enabled. This Jekyll and Hyde kind of double personality, schizophrenia, in the country. And we're going to have that again. So now the states that are pro-abortion are just going to throw out all the limitations on abortion and abortion on demand. And at 1 minute before childbirth, you can abort the fetus and so forth, and then you're going to have states that totally ban it, and we haven't resolved the issue, and so we just created more separation. But on the one hand, it is a partial victory. It's a partial victory, but conservatives are happy as if they had just won the game. It's like you know, someone saying, okay, we can go home because we're up, you know, 10 to 7 in a football, American football game, and it's halftime. But it's halftime. There's still another half to play. There is something fundamentally wrong with the whole system, where the whole system cannot come up with a decent explanation for why abortion should or should not be legal. It's not there because, as we've explained so many times in these audio snippets, the right to life is not defined, clearly defined in the Constitution. The closest thing we have to the right to life is the First Amendment. And the right to life, I'm not talking about what conservatives refer to as the right to life, just the right of the fetus to live. We're talking about the right to life of the born in general, the right to be free. That concept is not in the Constitution. So how can we even attempt to extend that right to a fetus when it's not even clearly defined for the post-fetus people, the people who have been born? So we have a system that is so inept, so fundamentally, metaphysically inept at resolving this problem, that we go, okay, let each state decide, because we're not going to fix the system. That's what conservatives are basically saying. We're not going to fix the system, and we're just going to have this, we're going to go back to that escape valve that the founding fathers left in the system, federalism, so that whenever we don't know what to do, let each state decide on their own what they want or not want to do, instead of resolving the issue. That's how we had slavery. That's how we have had so many other things. And we're now going to that on the abortion side. And instead of saying, okay, that was a great thing, but let's figure out something more permanent. And no one does it. No one does it. That's why I'm so disappointed. And the more time goes by, I realize, okay, I see this country is dying. It's already dead. The Republic died in 2008. We've already explained that. We've been in this state of coma, or I don't know how to explain it. It's like we're dead as a concept, as a national concept of a nation. And we're on the verge of having the plug pulled on us. And we're a short time away from America being declared officially dead forever. And no chance of a new republic, no chance of anything. That's how close we are. And I see the time ticking, and I don't see the U.S. Responding to the call. Sorry about the digression. The thing is that the people like James Monroe and even Henry Clay, who were aware that slavery was a problem, realized that to solve the problem, they had to have a strong federal government to override federalism to resolve the problem in some way. Unfortunately for them, the solution was to ship all black people back to Africa. And then we have, after James Monroe, we had as the sixth president of the United States, we had a man named John Quincy Adams, who happened to be the father of, or I'm sorry, the son of John Adams, the second president of the United States. And I think, if I'm not mistaken, that John Adams and Quincy Adams are, along with George H.W. Bush and George W. Bush, are the only parent-son teams, you could say, that have been president of the United States as father and son. And this John Quincy Adams, who followed Monroe as president, wrote in his private journal, and this was in reaction to the Missouri controversy. The controversy with Missouri is that Missouri was, there was a question, do we allow slavery in the Missouri territory or don't we? And obviously the people in the South, because Missouri was kind of borderline with the South, people in the South wanted Missouri to be another slave state. And the Northerners, anti-slavery people, wanted no slavery in this new territory or state. And so there was this discussion, and he wrote in his private journal, quote, "The discussion of this Missouri question has betrayed the secret of their souls." This is John Quincy Adams talking, writing. "In the abstract, they admit that slavery is an evil. They disclaim it and cast it all upon the shoulder of Great Britain. But when probed to the quick upon it, they show at the bottom of their souls pride and vainglory in their condition of masterdom. They look down upon the simplicity of a Yankee's manners because he has no habits of overbearing like theirs and cannot treat Negroes like dogs. It's among the evils of slavery that it taints the very sources of moral principle. It establishes false estimates of virtue and vice. For what can be more false and heartless than this doctrine, which makes the first and holiest rights of humanity to depend upon the color of the skin?" Can you imagine these powerful words are being written by John Quincy Adams at the beginning of the 19th century? And he was spot on when he spoke about black people and how Southerners were blaming Great Britain for the slavery of black people in America, the hypocrisy of it, and how he was able to explain that these people knew that slavery was evil in the abstract, but they wouldn't let go of it because it became a source of pride to them, to be able to be above someone else, in this case, black people. So we see, and he became president, but unfortunately, even though he had these strong principles as president, he could not do much to end slavery, because that had to be done in the battlefield of Congress and in other places. And one man as president could not just come and change things. Monroe could have done more because he was from the South and a slave owner himself. And if he had taken the rightful attitude, the correct attitude towards slavery, I think he would have had a much greater influence on the people of the South, because it would have been one of their own telling the truth to them and confronting them about that, and that would have been much more influential. John Quincy Adams couldn't really quite do that, being a non-Southern slave owner. So he kind of did not get a chance to do much, and I think he was a one-term president, if I'm not mistaken. And in 1836, it must be pointed out, partially in response to Adams' consistent presentation of citizens' petitions requesting the abolition of slavery in the District of Columbia, the House of Representatives imposed a, quote, gag rule that immediately tabled any petitions about slavery. So this man was trying to do something. So he was going to, he would go and all the time present these petitions requesting the abolition of slavery to in D.C. So he was trying to do something about it, and that's what's so praiseworthy about this man. So he not only believed it, he was trying to enact legislation. That's why I'm saying the battlefield was the Congress, the people writing the laws. That's where people had to be convinced. That's where Henry Clay would have played a big role, but he didn't. And so John Quincy Adams was just putting in these petitions all the time, and they got tired of it. So by 1836, they said, okay, him and others who were presenting these petitions, you are we're not going to do anything about it. So they imposed this gag rule that immediately tabled any petitions about slavery. Like, we're not going to talk about it. We don't want to talk about it. We're going to suppress it. And the other thing that's interesting about John Quincy Adams is that he supported the assimilation of Amerindians via consensual agreements. So we've talked about how the left wing of the country has always kind of seen Amerindians as the separate people. They have to be treated as the separate group of people that don't belong to to the country, and that they are to be seen as this the separate group that has nothing to do with us, and we want to leave them alone because they have to have their own culture and their own value system. So we've said that that's not the right approach. We don't want to put people in reservations, and that's always been the Democrats or the left wing solution to problems like slavery. The solution was, let's ship them off to Africa, let's separate them, and the left also thinks that way about Indian people. Let's separate them, let's put them in reservations and so that they can preserve their own culture. But that's not the way it's supposed to be. And John Quincy Adams had that awareness. We don't want these people separated. They are part of America. Let's integrate them. Let's assimilate them. And not by force, but by consensual agreements. Let's bring them together. And that issue of this separation can be seen at so many levels. For example, with Black America, a lot of the problems we've had in America have had to do with slavery. With the housing projects that the left has promoted over the years. This free, affordable housing for poor people, wink, wink, Black people. It sounds so merciful, so compassionate, but what it ended up doing is just putting together all these Black poor people and putting them in this place of poverty and death, instead of helping to integrate Black people into the mainstream of society. We were again putting them in the reservation, and these reservations eventually became cauldrons of criminality and despair and drugs and so many things that happened because we had this brilliant idea of putting all these Black people together. Liberals are always against this concept letting the Black American feel like he's an American because, oh no, that's destroying their culture and this and that and the other. And they know deep inside their evil heads that if that ever happened, they would no longer have a prime candidate for victimhood and manipulation. They need Black people to feel separate, isolated, like they're on the fringe of society so that they can be manipulated politically. And they don't want Black people to become a part of America where we forget that, you know, he's Black. We just think of him as a person. That's why they are always against the color blindness. Like, oh, we don't want to think like that. And as I've said before, there is a certain element of subtle truth to that, that in the sense that we can't just pretend there are no races. Races have characteristics. We have to understand them because there's a dynamic there. But having said that, when you deal with an individual, you deal with the individual. And the idea was for Black America to become part of America, assimilated into America as a group of individuals living in the rest of society with other individuals. The liberal doesn't like that. We have so far talked about some of the men that in the beginning of the 20th century and 19th century who could have had a stronger influence on slavery but didn't, and in the case of James Monroe and Henry Clay, and then a man who wanted to have greater influence but wasn't allowed to, in the case of John Quincy Adams. And then we'll talk more about what happened shortly after that, go into the Civil War period, and then past the Civil War period, to kind of see how things ended so sadly in the 19th century when it came to the issue of slavery and Black America. And we'll do that in the next audio snippet. Thank you very much for listening.